2 Corinthians 6:14. Be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship hath righteousness with unrighteousness? And what communion hath light with darkness? And what concord hath Christ with Belial? Or what part hath he that believeth with an infidel? And what agreement hath the temple of God with idols? For ye are the temple of the living God. As God hath said, I will dwell in them and walk in them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Wherefore, come out from among them, and be ye separate, saith the Lord, and touch not the unclean thing, and I will receive you, and will be a father unto you, and ye shall be my sons and daughters, saith the Lord Almighty. And the Pilgrim Fathers took the admonition of this portion of Scripture very literally, and they really had no choice. Our tour was taken geographically rather than chronologically. But I want to give you a bit of the chronology so that you can understand some of the geography. And I'll try to paint you a little picture of where we went. It was, of course, in the 1500s when Henry VIII essentially took the Anglican Church, which was the church, out of the Roman Catholic system. He did that because the Pope wouldn't grant him a divorce so he could marry another woman that he wanted to. And, of course, he had a number of wives, about seven, I guess. Some of them died natural deaths. He had some of them executed. And, of course, he had to divorce one in order to get another one and so on. And he was, of course, trying to get an heir out of all this. And it was very providential that the Lord used even all of that foolishness to produce a climate in England which contributed to the Reformation in England. Because there were men there who were godly men, who loved the Lord, who knew the Word of God very well, who were beginning to teach and preach their people the Bible. And they wanted to get away from the cold liturgy of their churches and have practical ministry to these people to help them live their lives for the Lord. Well, when the Anglican Church then essentially separated from the Church of Rome, what they had for quite a while was Catholicism without the Pope. And as a result of not having that ecclesiastical heavy-handedness of Rome on the Anglican Church, more of these men began to be very bold in their proclamation of the truth in their churches and in their whole parish. Now, many of the cathedrals and churches that were being used in those days still stand today. There are buildings that were built nearly 1,000 years ago that are still standing, but not too many. But most of those are some of the older and larger cathedrals. But there are certainly churches that were standing during the times when the pilgrims were preaching. And many of the pilgrim fathers were bishops of certain regions or parishes. And these were Bible-believing men who took a strong stand. And they began to have an argument with the Anglican Church over certain basic issues. The Anglican Church, of course, used a Book of Common Prayer. And the Puritans felt that people should pray from their hearts to the Lord, rather than just reading prayers, although they were doctrinally sound. They felt it should be a more open and fluid kind of communication with the Lord. Instead of following the liturgy, they wanted to be able to preach expository sermons to their people and to nurture the people from the Word of God. And by the time that the pilgrims that came to America were already here into the middle of the 17th century, along about 1656 or so, a pastor named Richard Baxter wrote a tremendous treatise on practical application of biblical truth, Christian Directory, and it had all kinds of practical information in it that was a wonderful help to the people. And then, of course, he wrote The Reformed Pastor, which in its original, and that doesn't mean Reformed theology, it means revitalized pastor. It was a huge, huge book, but many abridgments exist now, and they're much more manageable, and it's very, very practical. I quoted from it on some on Sunday morning. But a lot of these kinds of practical emphases were the desires that the Puritan or the Pilgrim Fathers had. But that didn't go over very well. And the thing that really brought the conflict to a head was the issue of vestments. You know what I mean by that? Clerical garb. Have you ever wondered why they call clergymen men of the cloth? Well, if you look back into history and you see how the professions all identified themselves with their clothing, the academic regalia, for example, of the cap and gown and the mantle of the different schools of study came into use in those days, and the different guild trades were identified by certain distinctive clothing or features about the way they would dress. And the teachers at Oxford and Cambridge actually taught in their gown, and would wear their mortarboard cap. It was their headgear. It wasn't just what they used for graduation ceremonies. It was their daily way of dressing, and it identified them as an academician. Well, the churchmen also had their clerical clothing, and it was extremely elaborate. And the headgear with all the things, of course, that you still see in the Anglican Church and in the Roman Catholic Church today. Well, the Puritans felt like this was an offense, and it attracted all the attention to the people, or to the man, the preacher, rather than to the God that he was proclaiming. And they didn't want to wear this. Now, you look back at the way some of those folks dressed in those days. You'll see pictures of Wesley, which was much later. It was 100 years even after Baxter. But you'll see them. They'll have on a black coat or a robe of some kind, and a white collar with tabs or something like that coming down. And then, of course, many of them would still wear clerical collars. And many of the Protestants over in the United Kingdom today will wear clerical collars and have no problem with that, whereas we would just wear a business suit here in America. But that was very conservative, very modest, compared to the clerical vestments that the men wore in the Church of England. And the Puritans said, we're not going to do this. We don't want this Book of Common Prayer. We want to be able to preach the Bible and not just follow the liturgy, and we don't want to have to wear these vestments. And they refused to do it. And as a result of that, of course, in those days, there was a serious connection between the government and the church, because the king was the head of the church, as well as the federal head of the governing body, and so he had tremendous authority in both political and religious affairs. And so to defy the church was, in effect, to defy the king. And they were in a real dilemma, and they were trying to decide what to do. Now, I don't know if you can picture England in your mind, and I can't draw you a map here in the air, but the island is England and Scotland. And then to the northwest, there's another island, which is Ireland. And that's the Republic of Ireland, and the little tiny corner of it up in the northeast is called the Northern Ireland, or the 10 counties of Ulster are there, and so they call themselves Ulster. That's what they call their country. They are Protestant, stayed with England. The Republic of Ireland was Catholic and got their independence from England back in the early part of this century. So you got England, Ireland, Scotland, and then a little country called Wales, W-A-L-E-S, not W-H-A-L, Wales. And so the people there are Welsh, and they speak a strange tongue. It uses English letters, but they don't have all the letters that we have. And so in order to get certain sounds, they have to combine some of the letters that we do have. For example, they have a double L at the beginning of a word, which is sort of like CH, but not exactly. It's sort of like kh, like that. And they call their country Cymru, which sounds nothing like Wales, but that's what they call it. And they speak a language which is totally different from anything you've ever heard. And then they have a lot of other double vowels and things like that. For example, if they don't have an F in their alphabet. So the way they get an F sound is they have a double D. So if you go to Cardiff, you look at the sign, it's spelled C-A-R-D-I-D-D, Cardiff. And you wouldn't think that. But to hear them speak, and they're very sweet people, and of course they all speak English as well. So we spent some time there. But at any rate, you have England, Scotland up here, Wales over here, Ireland over there, for what that's worth. Okay, and so what we were doing was traveling from London over to this coast, up to Wales, and then back up to the north of England here, and then we went across the sea to the Netherlands, and then home. But that's not the way it took place with the Pilgrim migration to America. As the 1500s wore to an end, things were becoming much more intense. More and more of these men were separating. Many of them by this time had been burned at the stake by Queen Mary. And of course, Latimer and Ridley and Cranmer, these were men who all lost their lives. And these were all bishops and in key positions of leadership at the various colleges of theology at Oxford. And burned in the streets at the stake in Oxford. And it was a horrible time of persecution. And yet, that persecution just strengthened the resolve of more and more of these Puritan people. And they've been severely misrepresented in our history. I can remember in the public school as a kid studying American history and learning about the Puritans. And what we were told, of course, was that they were very severe, legalistic people who only wore black clothing, you know, and black hats and white collars. And, of course, the reason is that everybody in the United Kingdom dressed like that was a gentleman in those days. But that isn't true. They wore colorful clothing. And they were happy people, and they had recreational activities. They were clean, separatist people. But they weren't what they were made out to be. And they didn't go around all the time trying to find a witch to burn and all those kinds of things. In fact, many of them were burned. So a lot of that history is totally inaccurate if you were taught that like I was in your school. But by the end of the 1500s, it was becoming apparent that these people were not going to be able to maintain the purity of their faith. And so they began to separate. Now, the way they did it was they were either defrocked or had their ordination credentials removed so they couldn't preach anymore, or they pulled out by themselves, and they started meeting in different places. Now, the group that eventually came to America was in the northeast of England, not too far from Scotland, and there's a little series of towns there. Gainsborough is one of them, Boston, Scrooby, Austerfield, Babworth, and some of those cities. And many of the preachers who were in those towns would take their congregations, either wholesale or whoever wanted to go with them, and they would begin to meet in other places, in their homes or in other public meeting halls. And then, of course, the king would find out about it. Gainsborough particularly was on one of the postal routes between London and Scotland. And William Brewster, who was one of the Pilgrim Fathers, was the postmaster. And he had a lot of authority because everybody who was traveling through that area, which, by the way, a little fictional history here, was in the Sherwood Forest. All right, so everybody that came through there would stop at the postmaster's home and the Gainsborough Old Hall, and they would have all kinds of connections and communications. Well, obviously, with that kind of travel going through there, eventually word got back to the king that a bunch of these separatists were meeting in the public hall. Well, they couldn't have that, and so they had them all arrested and began to persecute them and that sort of thing, threw their pastors in prison. So the people thought, if we're going to have true faith, we've got to get out of this country. We've got to leave here. We've got to come out from among them and be separate. We can never worship the Lord honestly if we're going to stay here. So they began to put together a plan to flee to Holland. And they tried that in 1607. But a lot of problems occurred. They got together at one little area there on the coast, and they had hired a ship, and the tides were not right, and there were a number of problems, and they were out there. There's a little river that came back to the city of Boston, where John Cotton was the pastor, who later came to Massachusetts and founded the city of Boston and pastored there and wrote some wonderful commentaries, which most people today, I think, would find them incredibly boring, but they're tremendous treatises. And so that's the same man. He was pastoring there in Boston, which, by the way, is where John Fox was born. You might know what John Fox did. He wrote a book called Fox's Book of Martyrs, the Christian Faith, and one of the greatest books ever written, which you ought to read. But at any rate, a lot of history there. So these people were there on the coast near Boston, a little creek, and their ship was coming in, and they had paid the ship's captain to come and get them, and they had all snuck out there under cover of night and gone down the river to get on the boat there in 1607. And just about the time that they were getting in their little boats to go out to the ship to be taken over to Holland, on the horizon were seen Her Majesty's ships. Actually, at that time, it would have been His Majesty. And guess which Majesty it would have been? 1607. King James, okay, who was the one who was responsible for all that persecution at that particular time. And so the King James Bible was in the process of being written at that time, or translated there at Oxford, or at Westminster Abbey. But at any rate, the captain of the ship sold them out. And he kept their money. And this was typical of what these people went through time and time again. And so they took them all back into Boston, and they put them into what is now the old Guildhall. In other words, at the time it was the courthouse, and then it became the Guildhall, which is where all the different tradesmen would meet, and they had developed commerce and so on. Well, the courtroom where they were tried is still there, and you can still see it. And there's a spiral staircase right behind the bar that they had to stand behind. I'm not sure you've ever heard of someone taking their bar exams or standing before the bar, that sort of thing. It's literally a bar, like a handrail that's shaped something like this pulpit, but it's just an open bar, and they would stand behind that and be tried. And then right behind it there was a spiral staircase, and that went right straight down to the jail. And you can see that as well, where they were locked up there. So they kept them locked up for a while, and some of them for quite a while. And, of course, they let the women and children go, and they weren't able to get away. So eventually, after some of them spent quite a while in jail, they were released, and they went back to Gainsborough, and they tried to have their meeting there for a time, and they came up with another plan. And so in 1608, they escaped. Only this time, it was a little further north in a town, a city that we would know today as Hull. Or Hull, as Kingston is the name of it. Kingston upon Hull, they call it. And the river is there. And so they were able to escape from there. But again, there were complications. They were loading the ship. The men got out there and were getting things secured and getting all provisions made. And as they were trying to leave, the women and children were still on the coast. And as they were trying to leave, the tides became contrary. The ship was going to run aground. They had to go further out to sea, and they were driven by winds, and all the women and children were stranded on the shore. And the men escaped, and they sailed on to Holland and left the women and children there behind. And of course, all of them were rounded up and thrown into jail. And after just a few days, the magistrate thought, what are we going to do with these people? We can't just keep these women and children locked up, and their husbands are all gone now. If they want to leave, let's just let them go. And so, to make things easier for themselves, they let them go. So finally, in 1608, they were all joined together back there in Holland. John Robinson was their pastor, and William Brewster went with them as well. And he had a printing press there, and he produced material. And they all lived there, and they stayed in Holland from 1608 until 1620. And while they were there in Holland, a number of things took place. First, their children weren't learning to speak English. Secondly, they were being harassed by the Dutch for their quaint ways, and many of the children were becoming extremely frustrated, had no playmates except their own family and friends there with the pilgrims. They were living in like a little commune area, and so some of the children were sort of defecting and not wanting to follow the faith of their parents because they didn't have the supportive culture of their own homeland. Does that sound familiar? And so they thought, we've got to get these children out of here. What are we going to do? And so finally in 1620, they decided we've got to sail away. It's very interesting. John Robinson was nearly killed. He was beaten up very severely and was accused of being an Arminian. And the reason that he was accused of being an Arminian is because he conducted debates as a Reformed theologian. He engaged in debates with Jacob Arminius, who lived right down the street from the place where they lived in the church, St. Peter's Kirk at Skull, or St. Peter's Church, there in Delft, Holland. Was it Delft? Yes, it was, in the Netherlands. And he was often seen with Jacob Arminius. And the Reformation that was taking place, of course, in Holland at that time, was, of course, very much opposed. And Calvin, of course, was leading that. And there was a tremendous opposition to that. So the pilgrims were accused of being Arminians and attacked in the streets. And because many of the Dutch couldn't speak their language, didn't really know what they stood for. And there was all kinds of persecution and problems. So finally, they made their plans to escape. And they were going to come to America. So they bought a boat called the Speedwell. And that was poorly named, by the way. It didn't make it. But they bought this boat called the Speedwell. It's about a third the size of the Mayflower. And the Mayflower, if you compare it to a ship today, would be a tiny little thing. But for that day, it wasn't a bad-looking ship. And so they bought the Speedwell, and they were communicating. I have no idea how they were able to maintain such effective communications. But they communicated very clearly with the Pilgrim Fathers who were still back in England. And, of course, from time to time, some of them would travel. And, of course, Brewster's printing press really helped them because they were able to send literature back over to help disciple the people and children and the new converts and so on there in England. But then there were a group of people. There were some from down in Dartmouth and Portsmouth and Plymouth and those areas which were in southwestern coast of England. And then there was that little knot of them that had remained in England that were still separatist up around Scrooby and Babworth and those cities up there. Then there were some in London, and they were kind of scattered out, and they had a network of communication among themselves, and they put together a group of people that had decided, we are going to go to the New World. And so they got a charter from a company, and they had to go over and found this particular plantation for that company. That's how they got their charter from the king to be able to do it. But they had to be very careful because they were essentially outlaws. So they left in 1620 from Holland. The Speedwell didn't sail down under the island of England or the United Kingdom, and then came into the port there at Dartmouth, and they met up there with the Mayflower. And they all got together and were leaving from there, and they went out about 2 or 3 days, and the Speedwell started leaking. And historians are not really sure whether it was all that bad or whether the captain just really didn't want to go. And so they went back in for repairs, and this time they put in at Portsmouth. Or it may have been Dartmouth. When I go through that another time, I'll give you all those details. But they put in and made repairs. And then they took off again, sailed out about 2 weeks. And this time the Speedwell was leaking so bad that it just wasn't going to be able to make the trip. So they had to go back to England again. Well, by this time, they're already eating the food that they were going to need to get through the winter. They had their food for the trip. They had their food when they got there. And it was going to be so late by the time they got there. And it was just so discouraging, so overwhelming. They had been robbed and just ripped off by so many people and persecuted and driven away. And all these struggles and problems that they're having. And so finally they get back in there and they decide they're going to abandon the Speedwell altogether. So I don't know whether they sold it or just abandoned it or got rid of it. But then, of course, they couldn't all go on the Mayflower. So they had to decide who was going to go and who was going to stay. And so they made up their mind that they would leave certain ones behind. And then, of course, they had to have the crew, many of whom were not pilgrims at all, but just sailors. But they had to sign a contract that they would stay for 1 year with the plantation once they got over there. And so finally they were able to set sail and make the journey and get over to Massachusetts in the fall of 1620. They were trying to get away ever since back in the summer. And finally in the fall, they were able to get over to Massachusetts. And interestingly enough, the charts that they had purchased when they left Plymouth, England, from which they had finally sailed, and they were going up and down the coast trying to find a safe harbor, there was a city marked on their map named Plymouth. And they took that as providential, sailed in there, and of course founded their colony. And the first winter, over half of them died. And all but four of the women died. And several of the children. There were two people. One fellow who was a real complainer and even tried to sabotage the ship was swept overboard and really put the fear of God in the unsaved sailors, because the people had prayed that the Lord would deal with him, and he swiftly did. And he was taken sick and died. There was another fellow, I'm sorry, that was swept overboard, but was providentially saved, able to catch onto a rope. Two babies were born on the trip, and very interesting. By the way, one of the things we learned in the church there in Delft, we saw a display there, is that George Bush is a direct descendant of one of the Mayflower Pilgrims. And there was some other interesting heritage like that. But basically, that's the history of what we did, and or of what we were studying. And we were studying who these persons were, and why they did it, and where they went, and how it all took place. Now, another time, I'm not going to take any more time tonight, but another time we'll explain to you about some of the things that we saw, and hopefully I'll be able to get the scrapbook thing together and leave it back on the table, and you can see some of the pictures. But, you know, a lot of it would be meaningless to you. Pictures of plaques, you know, and monuments and things like that. And you think, well, what is that? But one thing, that it was a life-changing experience. We studied some other things that were of ecclesiastical interest to us and historical interest, and then other just old tourist-type stuff. I mean, Stonehenge, you know, what does that have to do with the pilgrims? But you can't drive by it without stopping to see it, you know. And we drove right by the thing, so we stopped and saw that and hummed, you know, and all that. No, we didn't. But anyway, we just saw the thing and a little history and listened to all the evolutionary nonsense that they give you while you're looking at it, how many tens of thousands of years old it is and all that sort of thing, and then drove on. But we did see some other things that were just very affected us very much. We were in a little Celtic town. And I never saw so many New Age shops in my life. It was oppressive witchery everywhere. And, of course, to them it was all just fun stuff, you know. It wasn't fun to us. It was oppressive, and I couldn't wait to get out of there. But and then I mentioned to you that we saw the went through the Burrington Combe, which is where the Great Gorge is, and that place where it is reported that Augustus Toplady took refuge from the storm and was inspired to write Rock of Ages, and they have a plaque to that effect on the side of that stone, and many, many things like that, which were not directly related to the pilgrims. But one of the things that was most impressive to me was when we were up in this Scrooby Babworth area, where Gainsborough and all this, we stopped at Epworth. But you may recall, I've told you a number of times, that my father was a Methodist preacher for nearly 30 years, or over, and of course I knew all about Wesley and Francis Asbury and all those and the whole history of that thing, and we had visited the Wesley House when we were in London and so on. But we were able to go to the old Epworth, the church there, and to the Epworth Rectory, which is where he lived when he was a little child. Of course, it was the site where the home burned. I don't know if you're aware of this, but there were many kids in the Wesley family, and Charles and John were among the last. Not all of them survived. I think there were 16 of them, and only 11 of them survived, and John and Charles were near the end. And when John Wesley was just a little tyke, five, something like that, maybe six, their home burned. And he was trapped upstairs. And his father, who was a godly man, preacher, was just crying out for the Lord to do something. And of course, thatched roof, thing was just an inferno. And they thought surely they were going to lose the little boy. But some neighbors came. And we're able somehow with a ladder and some buckets of water to get the little fellow out. And there's that painting, which you may have seen a picture of. I've seen it many times in my life, of little Charles or little John Wesley being taken from the window of this burning home. And his mother, you know, later would sit him down and pray with him and say that God had a plan for his life, for you truly are a brand plucked from the burning. You know, and of course he wove that into many of his sermons and his journal and his biography and so on. But we saw all of that, and it was really something. But there when we were at the church, you may not realize that John Wesley died an Anglican in the 1700s. He never left the Anglican church, even though he founded the Methodist church. But he preached the gospel and traveled, I don't know how many, tens of thousands of miles on horseback. Was it 250,000? That number comes to mind. I know it was an amazing amount of traveling on horseback all over England, Scotland, and Wales, and even into Ireland, preaching the gospel. But he was not allowed to preach in his father's church because of his clear preaching of the gospel. And he was forbidden and ordered to leave. Well, there were many believers there, and he wanted to preach to them and their families and to encourage them. And right outside the entrance to this old stone church where his father was the pastor before he died, there's a graveyard, of course, around all those buildings. And the church is sort of a rectangular box with a steeple on one end, but the entrance to these things are on the side. And right next to that side entrance, there is a large rectangular tomb where John Wesley's father is buried. And when Wesley was forbidden entrance into that church, he announced that he would be preaching there anyway. And he went to the church and he stood in his own father's tomb and preached over 300 people down in that little vale in those woods. And of course, that's a tremendous testimony. And people heard him in numbers of souls. And he continued to preach. And whenever he was in that area, he would go and preach on his father's tomb in that place. And this last Monday, as we were there in Elizabethtown, Kentucky. And I'm not sure if you've ever been to a graveside service, but of course what they do is they put up a little tent and they'll put little chairs there. And then they will have the grave opened and covered, of course, with some rugs and different astroturf and things like that, and a little vault and so on. They had that all set up, and all of the grandsons, my three boys and the other three grandsons, were the pallbearers for my mother. And they took the casket and placed it on the little rollers there above the vault, and I took my place. And as I began to make my remarks, I realized I was standing on my father's grave. A month after I had stood where Wesley preached from his father's grave. And I have been struck with the reality of the fact that any of us who preach, indeed, preach on the tombs of those who've made it possible for us to know what we know, to believe what we believe, to stand where we stand. We have a great debt to these people, a great debt to our fathers and our forefathers. These original separatists who laid down their lives for the faith, who left family and friends and country and everything for Jesus Christ. And they're with him today. Isn't that a wonderful thought? And you and I may be called upon sometime in this life to make a sacrifice as well, but remember this. What fellowship hath Christ with Belial, with light, with darkness? Come out from among them. Be separate. He said he'd be a father to us and he'd receive us. And that's a wonderful promise. And if you and I are ever called upon to make those kinds of sacrifices, it would serve us well to know this history and to follow in their footsteps. Father, thank you for the time together tonight. I pray that you bless now and help us to have the kind of backbone that these people did, to be willing to make the sacrifices that they did, and then to stand where they have died for Jesus Christ. In his name we pray. Amen.